Hello and welcome to another episode of the Shock Doctors Podcast. I'm Jim Smith.
I'm Matt Gerandese.
And we are the Shock Doctors. In this episode, we're going to be discussing the long-delayed film Antlers, which, I was remarking to Matt on our way to the movie theater, I think is the last of the pre-COVID long-term postponements that we've been waiting on.
Yes, the last of the COVID casualties to be exhumed, to rise from its grave. And stock multiplexes nationwide. Quite spooky.
Yeah. Our next episode is going to be Last Night in Soho, incidentally. And even though they were both delayed to a certain extent and both came out on the same day, Last Night in Soho, to my understanding, was only pushed by like 6 months, whereas Antlers was like a year and a half.
Yeah, I felt a little silly buying my movie ticket tonight when I have probably seen... This is perhaps a slight exaggeration, but it certainly feels as though I've seen the trailer for Antlers cumulatively a feature-length amount of times. I've been watching that trailer for about half of my natural life.
So, it's about a child who is feeding a Wendigo.
Yes.
Essentially. There's more to it that obviously we're about to get into, but that is what I would term the elevator pitch.
Yes, and if they'd delayed it for even one more month, they could have maybe put some asses in seats by tricking people into thinking that it was like a Yuletide horror movie with that title, you know, Donner and Blitzen and so on.
Krampus.
Right. Not in love with that title, but I think that's because I had... a year and change to sour on it.
Yeah.
Antlers. It doesn't exactly strike fear into my heart. Although, once you get a look at them, the antlers are fairly foreboding.
Yes.
So we open in Oklahoma, I believe.
No, Oregon. Come on. It's got that whole Pacific Northwest the time.
You're right. We open in Oregon.
We open in one of those O states.
And there's a boy in what appears to be like a disused train depot or a scrap metal yard or something. It's a mine that's being worked on in some capacity, excavated or stripped for parts or something. And
it's deserted, yeah, almost.
The whole, yeah, well, it's Scott Cooper, so it's rust belt, poverty, desertion everywhere you look. That's sort of his métier. So the kid's dad is with him, you know, stay in the car. And he goes down into the shafts and there are spooky noises down there that sound sort of coyote-esque, but are a little difficult to pin down and trigger an instinctual fear response in him and his buddy. Let's get the fuck out of here. Early on, before the two of them even cross paths, he lights a flare as he's moving through this tunnel. And there's nothing that gets me in the mood for a creature feature quite like a character lighting a red flare in a dark tunnel.
Yeah.
It takes me right back to Alien, Aliens, The Thing. It's just as classic as it comes. So movie gets off on the right foot as far as that goes. And then the two of them are attacked by a big spooky something or other that we don't get a good look at.
Incidentally, they're running a meth lab in this disused mine. That's what they're doing in there.
Yes.
And that's why the kid can't come in, because, you know, chemicals, fumes.
Yeah, and the imagery of the meth mask recurs periodically throughout the movie. The kid ends up wearing it at some point, which is sort of a grim mantle.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of, again, it being Scott Cooper making a movie in the wake of the opioid epidemic and whatever else, all this desolation, it's bound to touch on some of those grim subjects. So we get introduced to our main character 3 weeks later, who is the sister of the sheriff of this small town. She's a school teacher. We're introduced to her in her classroom, and first time we lay eyes on her, she's standing in front of a chalkboard that has in enormous letters written storytelling on it, which is how you know a horror movie has delusions of grandeur, you know, whether it's the teacher in Halloween, which I know you just watched,
right,
talking about fate, or whatever Lin Shaye says in Nightmare on Elm Street, which I don't recall quite as vividly, which is weird because I've seen it way more recently, but I'm willing to bet it has thematic import, whatever it is. It's an old trope and one that kind of put a smile on my face. So she's teaching a class of, what would you say, like fifth graders? sixth graders.
Here's the thing that threw me off.
The kid says he's 12, which looks impossible.
Well, right. So the kid, again, yeah, he says he's 12. He looks like he can't be more than 9. He's just a very small, presumably undernourished.
Yes.
That's why he's so small.
Very slight and timid.
Child. Incidentally, we quickly come to find that this is the older brother and thereby eldest son of the two that we saw earlier, you know, the man and the boy.
And when last we saw his younger sibling, I forgot to touch on this, he's going into the mine, going, "Dad, Dad," lingering in a dark doorway with sparks coming out of it like fireflies almost wafting past his face.
Yeah, floating
so we figure
embers.
Title drop. 3 weeks later, here we are.
Yeah, but meanwhile, the classic kid bully character,
yes,
looks to be like twice his size and
like,
5 years older.
He looks like he's been held back a baker's dozen times. Yeah, he looks a good deal older. And it's funny, he is the classic bully in every respect except his shock of ginger hair. Normally,
right.
Back in my day, gingers were at the bottom of the food chain. You know, the whole gingers have souls thing. The vintage South Park, all that crap.
Or no souls,
no
as soul. The case may be.
Well, there was the kid who went viral, the chubby ginger kid.
Right,
gingers
right.
have souls! You know, that's
right.
I think of that before I think of South Park, oddly enough.
That's fair enough.
Truly a bygone era.
So, yeah, looking at our main kid, we think elementary school. Looking at this other kid, we think early high school or held back middle school.
Juvie, in one case or another.
Presumably it's middle school if, you know, they're 12 or 13. So she teaches middle school. It's Carrie Russell, incidentally.
Is the teacher, yeah.
Her brother, the sheriff, is Jesse Plemons. And soon we also will meet retired sheriff Graham Greene,
mm-hmm.
who is delightful.
Yeah, I like Jesse Plemons, too. I like all three of them. I'm going to have more to say about Jesse Plemons in particular after the break. Say it with me. So none of the kids, except for this one fucking Hermione in the front row, are taking the bait. The teacher asks, can anyone
tell me a myth?
A myth, a fable, perhaps a legend, a fairy tale even. And it's like Celebrity Jeopardy in there. The kids have got nothing.
Yeah, she cold calls like three different kids, one of whom is Lucas. The main kid. And finally, yeah, she gives up and lands on Hermione.
Mm-hmm. So she assigns them to all write their own myth, their own story. She goes home. She's just moved here recently after having run away from home when she was younger. We get this in drips and drops. She's got a somewhat fractious relationship with her brother, who she left behind in an abusive home situation when she split.
Yeah, their mom died when they were both young, and their father, it's not clear whether he just didn't take it well and that led to the abuse, or that just, like, removed the obstacle to the abuse, but either way, he, you know.
I hadn't ruled out the father killing the mother, frankly, given that everything
possible.
We learn about him is completely vile.
But yeah, so did a lot of the worst stuff imaginable to young Carrie Russell, and then presumably other stuff to Jesse Plemons after
mm-hmm.
she left.
So Plemons is the newly elected sheriff, although we're given to understand that no one else was vying for the position.
He and, says as much.
Yeah, right. And his job seems to consist mainly of enforcing evictions, which, again, is very Rust Belt, Scott Cooper, kind of a very Scott Cooper note to include.
Last night, I think I watched the first episode of American Rust, which is a Showtime miniseries with Jeff Daniels, where he plays like a Rust Belt sheriff.
Uh-huh.
And he also has to, I don't think he's supervising an eviction. I think he's keeping the peace at a foreclosure auction.
He's turning people out of house and home one way or another.
Right.
So the two of them commiserate a little bit. The following day, we get Lucas's fairy tale. The teacher makes a point of calling on him in particular. He gets up. He's got, you know, shy kid written all over him. He's got like Dear Evan Hansen posture in this shot when he's reading. He's got he doesn't have it written down. He's looking down as though he's reciting something he's written, but it's a sketchbook. It's a series of illustrations, all of which are very macabre. Monsters yes. and darkness and fanged maws. And he says, "Once upon a time, there were three little bears. Papa Bear, Baby Bear, and Little Bear. Papa Bear and Little Bear got..." No, Papa, excuse me. Papa Bear and Baby Bear got sick, and Papa Bear was angry because there wasn't enough food, not enough meat. They didn't have enough food, but they still had each other, which is ominous.
I didn't know how to take, like, they still had each other to eat. Like,
in the Donner Party sense.
Yeah.
Not quite as Hallmark, not quite as wholesome. So the teacher, visibly shaken, is like, that's very good, Lucas. I'm so glad I picked on you. She pursues him when he leaves school, I think that day, and invites him. He's staring like a Dickensian orphan through the window of an ice cream shop. And she's like, oh, I was just about to go in. You care for a bite? And the two of them sit down and have this kind of strained conversation where she's trying to pick his brains. And when she touches on his home life, he bounces. I got to get out of here. And off he goes. He finds a dead animal on the way home in the woods. Its entrails are hanging out, and he waves off a crow or some carrion bird.
Mmm, dinner.
Yeah, right. Them's good eats. And takes it home to Papa Bear and Baby Bear, who I believe we meet now, or perhaps we've already glimpsed them. They're living in the attic, which is boarded up, and well, not boarded up, it's locked up with some heavy-duty locks on the door to the stairs leading to the attic. So he goes up there with meat and various foodstuffs in, like, old takeout containers and feeds it to them. Baby Bear, which is to say his younger brother, the kid from the prologue, is looking a little zombified, but seems not significantly worse for the wear. He's
not feral.
Right. Whereas Papa is off in the corner.
Entirely feral.
Yeah, growling and yowling and contorting his body in all kinds of unnatural ways.
I think it's in this scene where we first see that Dad's chest is, like, glowing orange.
Right. Yeah, he's got, like, oven lungs. It's it's
got, like, Iron Man 3 glow to
him. Yeah, right. We get two scenes now, almost back to back. I'm sure they're juxtaposed with something to create, like, a little bit of breathing room. But basically, we get two scenes in a row where Jesse Plemons comes up behind his sister and startles her. The poor schmuck just can't catch a break.
No.
he's doing everything in his power to not startle her both times. Because both times he's very taken aback. And the first time she's piecing together a ripped up illustration of Lucas's that he threw in the trash. And it's some real scary stories to tell in the dark kind of shit. It's a little boy in the mouth of some freakish beast. And he's like, oh, is that how they teach in California? That's not going to fly out here. It's like, you know, that monster is probably what the average Oregonian imagines when they hear the phrase critical race theory. He has maybe a right to be concerned. And then in the following scene, she's playing piano and her father, her late father, abusive late father, materializes behind her and starts groping her. And as he does so, the music becomes more discordant. She starts playing off key, and it cuts to a memory, we infer, of the dad naked on a bed holding a stuffed animal.
Yeah, I think it's her bed.
Yes, I'm sure it is, over his junk.
Just the decor in the room.
Yeah.
It looks like a child's bed also.
And he appears to be crying or, like, in distress, but it's a very disquieting image. It's not exactly the standard child sex predator kind. He's not, like, leering or, like, panting or anything.
He's got the lascivious face on when he's doing the groping, but yeah, he's far from leering when he's
in the flashback
in the fetal position.
Yeah, right. I could have done without the. Well, I'll talk more about that. Say it with me now after the break. But I think that shot does have some of the weirdness, some of the same impact of the bear blowjob from The Shining, where it's just like, I get the gist, but, like, the details are peculiar enough to sort of merit inclusion by virtue of their very weirdness. You know, like, it's not exactly. I could have probably done without it, but I appreciate the strange wrinkles. If you have to do it, I guess at least make it novel. So this is the second time that Brother Plemons comes up and startles her in as many minutes, it feels like. The kid the following day, Lucas, that is to say, is out in the woods setting traps, and he happens upon Graham Greene, who sees something that alarms him. It looks like an animal carcass, or looked like non-human remains to me.
I don't know. I saw, like, feet.
Did
like
you?
Human feet.
All right, well, you were paying attention, I guess. I was like, I've seen the trailer 30 times.
I don't need to watch this movie. Yeah, human feet and human shins. That's what I made out.
So he alerts Sheriff Plemons that he found part of a man in the woods in this...
Part of a man? That's the refrain.
Yes, precisely. The teacher, meanwhile, has taken Lucas's sketchbook to the principal, says, this is a cry for help. I can recognize abuse. Trust me on this. The principal is more concerned with Lucas's younger brother, who stopped showing up to school some time ago. She speculates that he's involved in the dad's operation, if he has one. It's kind of an open secret, seems like. Maybe some kids don't show up to school because the parents don't want the teachers to smell meth on their clothes. In any case, Lucas does not seem to be a priority for her. It seems like the classic case of the scene where the protagonist tries to enlist the help of a superior and it falls on deaf ears. Not so. Very shortly, the principal goes out to perform a wellness check at the Weaver home, the Wendigo house, and finds the locked door and unlocks it and goes up into the attic and is set upon by Frank Weaver, Papa Bear, after seeing the...
Mr. Wendigo.
Yes. After seeing the baby bear, the little boy who is looking...
Worse.
Corpsier. And she's like, oh my God, what did he do to you? And then she gets cannibalized.
Not as much as he's about to do to you.
Yeah. And I gotta say, you see a lot of Papa Bear in this opening stretch, more than I particularly cared to see. I mean, so much of the movie is so dimly lit, but whenever they get into that attic for some reason, it's not like they got floodlights up there, but it's still brighter than it ought to be, and you see more, I think, than you should. And that's particularly true for me here, because him cannibalizing her is just very Hills Have Eyes, you know? Mm-hmm. Because he's still... We said earlier that he's feral, which is true, but he's still totally humanoid, glowing chest notwithstanding. And then him eating human flesh, which is nice and animalistic and visceral. You know, he goes for the neck, then he goes for the eye socket, looks like, and he's tearing off ragged strips of skin. Nice and gruesome. And then what this triggers is like a Resident Evil cutscene. It's like he's contracted the T-virus, and he starts going like, rah! And, you know, stretching out his arms, and his like, face is looks like it's about to split open. And then what redeemed this whole segment for me was the moment just before the cut where antlers sprout suddenly from his mouth, which is quite alarming.
Yes.
And that sort of hooked me again and re-enlisted me. I was like, okay, all right. Now, the next time I see him, he's going to be way weirder looking. And
sure enough.
Sheriff Plemons and Graham Greene go into the mines, and there are all these bags hanging from the ceiling. Graham Greene calls them medicine bags for protection against malevolent spirits. And Jesse Plemons says, well, what are they here for? And Graham Greene
just stares at
doesn't
him.
Dignify that with a response, rightfully so. And Jesse Plemons excels at playing slow-witted dudes, guys who just like kind of quite aren't all there. I thought that he was like phoning in this role in the beginning, but as his character, as it becomes more apparent that the arc of his character is that he's this green sheriff who's getting in over his head, his performance won me over more and more, because he is just a little dim-witted at all times, but largely well-meaning, which is, you know, kind of the quintessential Jesse Plemons role, at least up till now in his career. There are exceptions.
Like, yes.
He was scary in El Camino, for example, and on Breaking Bad. That was him, wasn't it? I'm not making that up.
I think he's
Jesse's like slave owner.
That sounds right. I haven't watched El Camino yet.
Ah, okay.
But I believe he was in Breaking Bad for a stretch. He's also pretty weird in I'm Thinking of Ending Things.
That's true. But he still plays the kind of, you know...
It's like a cross between his like villain roles and his slow-witted roles.
I would agree with that.
Slow-witted villain.
I would concur with that. So... Slowly but surely, the slow-witted sheriff leads the investigation to the Wendigo house. They find human remains in the attic. Most disturbing of which being a human husk that is like burst open from the inside and is partially charred. And that was unexpected. I rather liked that. They're just good bodies in this movie. they reminded me of The Thing, which is high praise.
Yes.
Just people torn apart from within, in some cases, mangled. It's high quality work. The kid, Lucas, finds out that his father beast has flown the coop when he's being pursued through the woods by his ginger nemesis. And then the kid promptly gets eaten by Wendigo Dad.
Wendigo Dad. It's way funnier than Octo Dad. Sorry if I threw you off.
After the bodies are found in the attic, Lucas is sent to the hospital. Doctor explains, go figure, that he's pretty messed up, malnourished. You know, I mean, physically, he's not doing so hot, but then psychologically, God only knows. So his younger brother is missing. His father is missing.
Well, his father is presumed dead by people who don't understand Wendigo.
Right, because they identify the teeth on his human husk.
Yeah.
One guy who does understand Wendigos is Graham Greene, and he tries to enlighten Sheriff Plemons and the teacher, and she has an open mind.
Yeah, she's picking up what he's putting down, mm-hmm. and Jesse Plemons, and this is in the trailer that Matt and I have seen 30 times, uh-huh. and perhaps you have seen, you listeners as well. He lays all this out, and then Jesse Plemons says, well, what you're talking about is a myth. And Graham Greene's just like, for you, yeah.
For you, yeah.
And proceeds to explain, for Native people, it's an expression of our deepest fears, etc.
Cautionary tale, I think he calls it.
Yes.
So the bodies are piling up. They find the ginger bully's body, what's left of it, down by the train tracks. Jesse Plemons goes, tell me this was a train. It was not a train. And the coroner is very clear on that point, or just the first officer at the scene. I'm not sure what his designation is.
I think he's a coroner, because I think there are only two cops.
Yeah, he says this boy was bitten in half, not, you know, very much not run over by train wheels. And I just love, I can't tell you how many stupid horror movies I've seen, or even kind of good ones, where these podunk cops will take any excuse to blame, you know, if a body's found by the train tracks, doesn't matter if it's got human teeth marks on its face, it was obviously run over by a train.
Case closed.
Yeah, a lot of horror movies follow that playbook, and I'm pleased that this one didn't, because it's very aggravating. Julia is holed up with Lucas in Plemons' home, and they've taken him home from the hospital, and she's, again, trying to pick his brains. Your dad's dead, Lucas. No, that was my old dad. My new dad is with Aiden? Is that his kid brother's name?
Yeah.
My new dad's with Aiden. I just need to make sure to feed him, and he'll love me again. And then there is a howl out in the wilderness. He's here. So then we get two cops getting gored from behind in rapid succession. The first, his name escapes me, he's less important, ergo he's the one who gets gored fatally. The second is Jesse Plemons. Both of them are lured out to a shed where Aiden, baby bear, is whimpering, and then they get attacked by the full-grown Papa Bear Wendigo, who is indeed more antler than man at this point. He's got just a profusion of antlers coming out of his face.
More antler than man in that he is all antler and no man.
Yes. And the rest of him looks like an oversized Smeagol, I guess.
Kind of, yeah. It's very like the illustration that Graham Greene tries to show them in a book.
Very much so. Almost disappointingly so. I would like the creature from The Ritual. Is that what it's called? Mm. Who's like a totem pole made of flesh. Just has like a lot going on its torso. It's like a centaur, but when the horse part is over, you're only like a quarter of the way done.
Sure.
It's got like human hands and like several faces. I wish the Wendigo had a couple more surprises in store, because once you've seen that sketch, you basically have seen the thing. And I found its human chrysalis form underwhelming, so I was sort of banking on the actual thing being a little more interesting, which it is, but again, not as much of a curveball as I'd hoped for. So Julia finds her brother sputtering and delirious, bleeding, and she patches him up, and the two of them go to the mine. She knows that that's where Lucas is headed because Lucas believes that's where he'll find his father and his brother, not erroneously. So she calls for an ambulance and leaves the brother in the squad car. She goes inside, does battle with Papa Bear, and it's all over rather quickly. I thought there is a line earlier, it must have been Graham Greene, he's the resident expert, where he says that the Wendigo gets weaker and hungrier the more that it feeds, which might help to account for a kind of anticlimactic final showdown, although it doesn't play like, I mean, the Wendigo is still, you know, a good 10 or 12 feet tall, made of nothing but muscle and teeth. And it just sort of doesn't put up much of a fight, but not in like a mercy killing, like put me out of my misery kind of way. And like, it looks for all the world like it's defending itself, and she just kind of gets the better of it.
Kicks its ass.
Handily. Well,
it does not like the flares, apparently.
Which threw me because it eats the ginger kid in broad daylight. And I didn't, if it had been established that it was like a night beast, I would have been totally cool with that.
Well, I don't know that it's so much light specifically, because like you say, it did kill the ginger in daylight, but it just something, the flare has got kind of flame coming out of it. It might not like fire or things adjacent to fire.
Yeah. It does shriek like, oh, that's my kryptonite, which didn't feel adequately prepared for. I guess what I'm saying is that design-wise, the thing is as big and as tough-looking as like the alien queen, say, from Aliens, but whereas in that movie Ripley had to level the playing field legendarily, so, you know, with the power loader, here there's never that like improvisational moment where Julia has to somehow even the odds. It's just the flare kind of, you know, it is like a Frankenstein fire bad kind of thing. So she rips out its heart and kills it, which is
she does get an assist from Lucas too, before she knocks it down and rips out the heart.
And that was the recommended method, courtesy of Graham Greene, of course. And after Papa Bear is kaput, the kid Aiden, not Lucas, starts making these cat in heat noises, and it's clear that he's become the new vessel for the Wendigo, which is less of a, it's strange. I mean, it moves through people like a contagion in this movie. I'm not even done talking about that, because that's the note that the movie ends on. It's like a form of vampirism, where, you know, you catch it, but it's also described as a singular malevolent spirit traveling from host to host. And that's kind of how this plays. Like, as soon as the dad is dead, the kid gets way more Wendigo in a matter of seconds. He's got like the beginning of the antlers poking out between his lips and the glowing chest. And so then the surrogate mother has to step in and kill him over Lucas's protestations.
Initial protestations. She brings him around.
So that's no fun at all. And then epilogue, they're all on this quintessentially Scott Cooper dismal gray beach. It's just ash gray, rocky shoreline. And Jesse Plemons sort of pulls her aside and says, what are we going to do about this kid? You know, she wants to adopt him. He says, it's like raising a tiger cub. You never know. He talks about it like it's a foregone conclusion. Like he's got Wendigo in his blood. And
I don't know that it's so much that the kid's got Wendigo in his blood, just that the kid is psychologically damaged and he's going to end up fucked up as an adult.
I see.
I didn't read it as like a strictly monster thing.
In that case, that line doesn't jive with me for another reason, which is that the two adult siblings have been through so much insanity in their own adolescence that it's just a weird thing for him to say, because he turned out more or less well adjusted superficially. You know, they both did. They can hold down jobs. But I can't quite square that line no matter how I come at it. But
he says something at one point, and this is awfully ominous, like, do you think you'd be able to kill something you love?
Yeah, right.
Like, we're going to have to put this kid down. And the kid walks up and he basically has to be like, oh, hey, kid.
Oh, hey, you Lucas. Know? And then that line becomes even more telling when they turn their backs on him. And he has a telltale coughing fit. You know, never
and a
good
sign.
And
leaking some black ooze.
Yes.
Which is, yes.
And previously, you know, not that you need to be told this, because if a character's coughing up a black ichor, then they've become monstrous in some capacity. That's just the law of the land in movies like this. But we've seen earlier Aiden regurgitating black slime when being fed. I don't even know what, snack food or candy or something. Something that's not raw meat.
Right.
His body rejecting it and black ichor coming out of his eyes. So, yeah, Jesse Plemons is the new Wendigo, and that's the last shot of the movie, is him processing that fact. And it's a weird note to go out on, just because it's a brother-sister story, estranged brother-sister story. And by the end of one of those stories, you know, they only end one of two ways. Either one of the characters ends up valiantly sacrificing themselves, or they put their differences aside and bury the hatchet, and they're both still standing when the movie ends. Either way, they usually end up coming together one way or another. So I've never seen an estranged brother-sister movie where they end up like hating each other's guts even more at the end of the movie than they did at the beginning. So it just seemed to me like, oh, well, he'll probably do the right thing. You know, he'll probably tell her, and then they'll figure it out. You know, I mean, she'll have to put him down too. And then what, is she the next host? It was just such a cliffhanger-y, but like an empty cliffhanger. That's what I'm kind of trying to get across.
I didn't see it as cliffhangery. Like, I don't think there's meant to be any mystery there. It's just like, I don't think there's any question that he would tell her and that they would take the necessary steps. Uh-huh. It's just like we went through this awful ordeal and, oh, well, guess it's not over.
It's not over yet. Yeah, I can live with that. It's something about the abruptness of the cut to credits made it feel like more like an, oh shit, here we go again, like that kind of thing, rather than a nail in a coffin, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it would have bothered me a lot more if, like, it cut to credits with a butt rock sting to it or something.
Sure.
You know, like Malignant.
No,
know?
The music in this movie generally has a lot more self-respect than that.
Right.
Movie across the board has a lot of self-respect, which I'm here for. I like art house horror, and I liked a good deal of this movie. I'll get more into that after the you-know-what.
What's going on?
We found a part of a man in the woods today.
Part of a man?
I guess the other half was found in the mine. All this has got to be an animal, right? No animal that I've ever seen.
Hello, listeners. It's Jim, here as always during the break to tell you some stuff you probably already know. Please follow us on Twitter at ShockDoctorsPod, on Facebook at facebook.com/ShockDoctorsPod, or check us out on Apple Podcasts. Podcast is also available on Spotify, Stitcher, and TuneIn. If you've got an idea for a movie you'd like us to check out, feel free to send us a DM on social media or email us at shockdoctorspod@gmail.com. And now, back to the show.
Something is going on with Lucas. These drawings belong to a student of mine.
This is what was in the mine. It's a diabolical spirit.
Excuse me, this is a myth.
For you, yeah.
And we're back. So just to get into the whole Wendigo transmission thing, which I think is a bone of contention for Matt, and which I think I'm more or less okay with, and I'm going to explain how I see it and see if Matt is okay with that.
it's not gonna keep me up at night.
No, I know. I don't mean to oversell it, but so the way I see it is that violent contact, i.e., you know, some kind of impaling or other, sets you up. You're like a Wendigo carrier. Like, right. you are susceptible to being the Wendigo host. But
okay.
But the
Wendigo hasn't flipped the switch on you yet.
Yeah.
It's installed the switch. but so to speak.
Yeah, and then once that's happened, and then the Wendigo dies in one form, it can then grow inside you.
All right, I don't hate that. I think, and I try not to be a stickler for the rules in movies like this. Well, I try to have my cake and eat it too, which is a critic's prerogative. You know, if a movie is breaking its own rules in a way that feels kind of artless or just ill-judged or just not thought out, then it does get my ire, get my dander up. But typically, I'm not trying to catch, not trying to hold a movie's feet to the fire when it comes to that specifically,
right?
Unless the movie has blundered in one or more other areas and I'm already kind of not in its, it's no longer in my good graces. And I think that Wendigo, that's not the name of the fucking movie, Antlers does just enough things that irked me that I was like teetering on the edge of like, you know, do I give it the benefit of the doubt? Do I not? And I was apparently disinclined to do the to fill in the blanks that you filled in. But I think you filled them in very satisfactorily.
Well, yeah,
I can live with that.
It explains why the kid, Aiden, that is the younger brother, who has essentially been exposed to whatever the hell this is for just as long as his dad. Like, he does get visibly worse, but not nearly as bad as his dad does. And then as soon as Wendigo dad is vanquished, he's suddenly,
right,
you know, ejecting antlers from his mouth.
Uh-huh.
That's, you get corpsier and corpsier when you've been jabbed, but you don't get antlery until the Wendigo has to move into your body.
Well, and right until the Wendigo hops bodies, the kid, Aiden, is still totally cogent, like when he's in the attic.
Yeah, that too.
Whereas the dad, it's like rabies is eating the dad's brain. Meanwhile, the youngest son can form coherent sentences.
Still talk.
Yeah, right. I was derelict in my duties before. I said that the Wendigo design should have had a curveball of some kind. It did. It is wearing a flappy, dangling skin face over its Wendigo head. That was something to behold.
Yeah, awfully good.
Yes, okay. So credit where it's due. I screwed the pooch on that a little bit. It was
wearing might be overselling. It's really more in the manner of it was still stuck to its head,
yeah,
after it emerged from the human husk, and it never bothered to take it off.
Right, and then it does promptly peel off, and then you're just left with the Wendigo maw to contend with. But that was rather good. I appreciated that, and we did not get that from Graham Greene's sketch. So
no.
As I said, credit where it's due. Prior to that, I did find the fully evolved final cell Wendigo, as I said, slightly underwhelming. I think that it's the same kind of beef that I had with the aliens in A Quiet Place. I complained about this in our review of Quiet Place Part 2, where they just kind of rampage around a lot and they're loud and sloppy. Here, it's not true to the same extent. When he attacks people, the Wendigo, it is like getting gored by a rhinoceros.
Well, and also, you know, it's not like Quiet Place Part 2 or the tail end of the first one, where you get like a broad daylight, head-on, perfect look at the Wendigo.
Right.
You see way too much of the Quiet Place sound creatures in those movies. The Wendigo, they're in the mine, and yeah, there's the flare, and we get a pretty good look at it, but again, there's still shadows,
uh-huh,
it's still not perfectly clear, and really...
And at least that's the climax.
That's the climax, and it's really the only time you get a good look at the fucking thing, because prior to that, usually you hear it, and you see flashes of it, but when it's going to town on somebody, the camera's usually on somebody reacting to that.
Right.
If anything.
This is the same thing I said about Quiet Place. I wanted them to be a little stealthier, a little more spidery. It bothers me the more there because the monsters are so sensitive to noise. I don't know why they'd be so goddamn noisy.
Right.
You know, you'd think that wherever they came from is a planet that's graveyard silent, you know, or that, you know, not just like bleh, bleh, boom, boom, as they're like, you know, tripping over themselves. And
right.
Anyway, I'm not here to relitigate that movie. Here, I could have done with a little bit more silent, stealthy, creepy, a slightly lighter touch. But there's enough of that. I think if your mileage may vary, there's a fairly good balance from the quiet and the loud. I just think the trailer, which again I watched oodles and oodles of times, led me to think that this movie was going to be slightly artier even than it is, and a little bit more reserved in its depiction of the monster. And then when you got so well acquainted with Weaver, with the father in the movie's opening half, I was a little bit thrown by that. And then it's true that you don't see that much of the Wendigo proper after it's come out of the husk, but you've seen the drawing by that point, and it doesn't deviate from the drawing at all, the Leatherface touch notwithstanding, which I did like. So I don't know, it's a good creature feature, and it's got a good look, a good tone for the most part. You know, it's tonally consistent. There's not like obtrusive humor. It's very downbeat, but it's not, I don't know quite what it is. Scott Cooper for me is a filmmaker who just seems to be capped at like delivering 6s or 7s out of 10s. You know, he's just never, and there's some flicks of his that I haven't caught, but it's not that his reach really exceeds his grasp. That might be true for me just when she has to kill Aiden, just because as downbeat as the movie was, there was nothing in it that indicated that it was going to try to be that heavy.
Yeah.
You know, and so there, I think it wades into the deep end of the pool in a way that isn't really justified. I mean, of course, you've got the child molestation flashbacks from earlier, which I could have done without, weirdness notwithstanding. But that, unfortunately, is kind of par for the course in movies like this. You know, I wish that more of the childhood trauma to do with Julia and her brother had just been conveyed with dialogue, if only because that way you could have saved some of the horrifying details for nearer the end of the movie. I think I talked about this. Oh, what fucking movie was it? Swallow. When we reviewed Swallow,
yeah,
I went on a little rant about how Lars von Trier has an underrated gift for third act twists. Idiots has a good a twist in the third act. Antichrist has a good twist. Manderley and Dogville both have good twists in the third act. Dogville especially, I really did not see coming. And it's the kind of twist that like totally realigns your perspective and makes you understand, oh, that's why so-and-so, such-and-such character was behaving that way. He just has a way of kind of flipping everything on its head. Doesn't do it in every movie, but it's something he does often enough that I feel like he ought to have a reputation for it, and he just doesn't because he's not like Shyamalan about it. You know, it's not like it's not part of the marketing. It's not part of the brand. And I brought this up when we reviewed Swallow because Swallow also front loads some information to do with a traumatic backstory that I wish had just come to light in the third act when she goes and confronts the guy.
Right.
Here, I felt similarly, I guess. I think that because the two of them do get into it after a certain point and they talk details. She like turns on him at one point and says, you know, oh, did he break your arm? Did he look to you to satisfy his every desire or something like, or fulfill his every need? I don't remember exactly what she says. And then Jesse Plemons says, you don't know what he made me do, which is true because she ran away from home. And so that could have been a bombshell, you know. Instead, it's, you know, we have these kind of tacky flashbacks from earlier. I don't know. It's not necessarily even that I want that material to be handled more sensitively. I mean, I guess that's part of it, but more so, I just think filmmakers are sometimes, you sometimes do yourself a disservice when you bake,
when you front load that stuff.
Well, yeah, just because, and I understand it as like a screenwriter instinct. You want the character to have a special connection with the kid in their fifth grade or whatever class who's clearly a little rattled and has a less than ideal home life. And so you want to establish right off the bat for the audience's benefit, this is why it's important to the protagonist to get this kid sorted out. But I think just dial it back, you know, more of a drip feed, and it would be both more tasteful and I think more impactful, more resonant. I don't know.
Well, yeah, because in addition to setting up a better third act twist, like you say, it will dawn on you in retrospect, if you're paying attention, oh yeah, that's why Carrie Russell cared so much about helping this kid.
Well, and it would have, you know, the as it is now, the ice cream shop scene is pretty thankless. They have some kind of irritating banter about how ice cream is her favorite vegetable.
Yeah.
It's not a vegetable. And then, you know, the kid says donuts are his favorite fruit, you know.
After being prodded into it.
Yeah, right. And that scene could have been so much weirder and had a kind of tension to it if it wasn't really clear why she was being such a weirdo, you know, like why she had taken such a special interest in this kid. You could have initially been a little bit wary about her and her motives. Not like she was going to like lure him into a white van or something, but just like she's there's something a little off about this lady and I don't know quite what it is. And then eventually you figure out what it is. And then the movie enlists your sympathies on her behalf. Oh, I get it. You get a handle on her damage and it all falls into place. There's no falling into place moment as it is now. And I felt the same way about Swallow, which is maybe why I'm harping on about it too much now.
There's also at least two, possibly three scenes where Carrie Russell is in a convenience store in line at the register and she is staring like half longingly, half very tense at these bottles of booze and then declines to purchase them. I think the first time she actually like buys some stuff, it's like, is there anything else? No. And then the second time she's just in line and then ends up buying nothing after staring at the booze bottle. So it's like, okay, recovering alcoholic. And obviously we know why. But like you say, if we didn't have so much of the abuse stuff front loaded, maybe she's just a recovering alcoholic just because, and how does that feed into her motives relative to this kid? Like you say, we don't really know. Maybe that adds to some tension.
Yeah. Well, and it would be relatively innocuous. Well, not innocuous. It would be relatively inconspicuous here just because there's already subtext going on to do with being a Wendigo as an allegory for being a junkie, you know, or like having a crippling craving, an addiction of some kind. And so, you know, a character,
or being a victim of abuse.
Yeah, right. And so a character battling alcoholism obviously folds right into that. I alluded to this earlier when Lucas is cleaning up the principal's blood, which is all over the hallway. He's wearing the mask that his dad wore when he was cooking. So there's sort of a passing of the torch thing to that generational unpleasantness.
Right.
Fathers, sons, you know the drill. And, you know, this has been done to death in, I feel like vampire movies do it more often, but, you know, werewolf movies do it. Abel Ferrara movie, The Addiction, probably does it most explicitly. It's right there in the title. So it's a little old hat, but not necessarily unwelcome. You know, there's a montage after Lucas gets to the hospital where he remembers his dad fiending, descending into Wendigo-dom. And it is very much like, yeah, I had to chain my own dad to the radiator kind of thing for him to shake off the DTs. You know, it's framed that way. I mean, it's more body horror because he starts kind of decaying and going feral, but it's not, especially when you put it in this rust belt milieu, it looks very much like kind of a crack den nightmare. And of course, the line in the scene that I talked about earlier when Carrie Russell wheels on her brother and is like, oh, did he make you satisfy his every need? Did he make you do this? That line, whatever it is, I don't remember exactly how she puts it, but it is of a piece with the kid's line. You know, if I just keep feeding him, he'll love me again. So the addict abuse thing there, it's all very pointed. It's pretty unmistakable, I would think. And perhaps even a little overstated, although not by, there weren't any like groaner moments, at least not for me.
No. Yeah, it's hard to hit that sort of note exactly the right amount.
Right.
And I think if Antlers is at all off in terms of that amount, it's not by much.
No, it's a question of degrees. I think despite the emphasis on storytelling that's front and center when we first meet the teacher, the movie doesn't have, and this is not like a fair thing to knock the average run-of-the-mill horror movie for, but this movie seems to have it on its mind. So I think it's a fair point of comparison or a fair critique. It doesn't have like a mythic quality to it. You know, it doesn't have that kind of Guillermo del Toro fairy tale sort of flavor, despite all of this talk about the three bears and Fables and Legends and what have you. It's
which
a little...
is funny because he produced, I think.
I think he did. I saw his name in the credits somewhere. And on paper, this is his wheelhouse, you know.
Right.
But it just doesn't have, you know, I don't expect it to be the next Pan's Labyrinth or anything, or even the next Devil's Backbone. But it just doesn't, despite the dialogue emphasis on that kind of thing, it doesn't come through in like the filmmaking choices very often. The one possible exception might be the principal hesitating before she unlocks the door leading to the attic, which felt a little Bluebeard to me. That did feel kind of like a, you know, no, don't go in there, and not just in your standard horror movie, don't go in the basement, don't go in the attic kind of thing, but more of a,
don't you know there's a Wendigo in there?
Yeah, right, exactly. Don't go in that locked door, there's a monster, you know, that was suitably Brothers Grimm, I thought. But otherwise, the movie was fairly deficient in that regard, which is kind of a shame. It might be just because you see so much of the dad when he's just a cannibal. Just like a 28 Days Later zombie, for all intents and purposes. I do like the transformation. I do like the emerging from the human chrysalis, but it just makes the monster slightly too mundane for me from the jump. And then the movie somewhat recovers from it, even if the final showdown is a touch anticlimactic. I think some of the... I just wish the attic had been darker. I mean, it really is that simple. I think that's why I'm still... why it's still stuck in my craw, is because the solution is so simple. You know, you just... When Lucas is going around carrying the trays of roadkill and festering meat, he's always got a headlight strapped to his head, like a miner's helmet kind of thing, just so he can get around because the electricity in their house has been cut off. And that alone is such a scary touch. And they don't capitalize on that at all. There's one scene where, rather creepy scene, where Lucas is in bed at night and he hears like scratching. It's either coming through the floor or coming through his bedroom door. It's not clear which. And on the other side of the wall or door or what have you, he hears his younger brother whimpering like, "I'm hungry." And that gave me goosebumps a little bit.
And Lucas just puts on some earmuffs, you know, like he did.
Which surprisingly does not trivialize it. It actually makes it more disconcerting because you're like, oh, this is a fairly routine occurrence.
Yeah, no, he has practice.
Yeah, right.
And that's horrifying.
Yeah, and the look on his face is anything but casual. He's obviously...
This kid is good.
He's a very, yeah, no, it's a very good performance.
Yeah, I'm
rooting for him to go places. He deserves to.
We like harping on shitty, like, precocious horror movie kids, and on the flip side, praising the ones who aren't like that, and he is very much not like that.
Yeah.
Like, he is both worldly in the sense that he's been through some shit, and he knows how to muddle his way through an awful situation, but he's also very much still a scared kid at heart.
Right. And his build, you know, his slightness and some grime on his face can do some of the work, but yeah, it does come down to his acting, his nonverbal acting in particular. But I just feel, you know, him with that hat on, or the light.
The headlamp.
There ought to have been at least one false alarm scene where, like, he thinks the dad has gotten loose in this house with no electricity in the middle of the night. I mean, that could have been shit your pants terrifying, especially if you didn't know what the dad looked like yet. You know, if every time he'd gone up into the attic, you'd seen, you know, a claw here or a strand of drool there. I just wanted my imagination to run wild a little bit more, and it was never really given the opportunity to do so. There's one shot in particular that bugged me where it's intercut with business at the school, or maybe between the siblings, the adult siblings, where it just cuts back to the Wendigo house and you hear the like brr, brr, and the clattering and the banging on the walls, and the camera pushes through a keyhole and you see the dad's eye, this kind of roving pupil, and then it cuts away again. There was just something powerfully random about it. You know, like the camera movement through the keyhole felt like this sort of unwarranted intrusion of like a CGI element, almost like Harry Pottery, not Harry Potter, but like some kind of it had, I don't know, it felt like a Lemony Snicket thing. I don't know quite how to describe
really why stuck it, in your craw,
why it bothered me so much. But just, you know, I think at that point I had already decided that I'd seen too much of the monster in its human form, and so when the camera pushed through that keyhole, I was just like, this should just be scratching and growling on the other side of a wall. Please just let me, you know, I wanted to close my eyes. You know, I wanted to see less than what the movie was electing to show me. All right, I'm done prattling on about that.
Well, the weird thing for me, as far as your reaction to that goes, is that's prior to when we get the best look at Wendigo Dad.
That's true. That precedes the big feeding scene.
Because
maybe that was the moment when I
think maybe retroactively you're angrier about the keyhole eye shot than you might have been at the moment.
That's very possible.
I don't live inside your head. I don't know for sure.
No.
But I think prior to the big feeding scene, the attic is much darker because it's always nighttime, and then there is also no power in the house up to this point in every scene where Lucas is at the house. And he does have the headlamp on some of the time, and he goes up into the attic with the tray of food, and then his dad hobble crawls over and eats the food, and we do get just like snatches of looking at the dad in that context, and then he retreats into the corner with his raw meat, and then Aiden comes into the light, and he's relatively normal looking, and it is a change of pace. So I think there is definitely more of that, but the flip side is the principal goes over the house during the day,
right?
Which is just, of course she does. When else would she go?
Fair enough.
And unfortunately, that does necessitate that we just see more of the dad, unless Lucas has gone to the trouble of like blacking out the windows, but presumably he wouldn't have bothered.
Right.
So it's, I think I agree with you that even in that scene, we should see less of feral dad. And maybe they could have made it a little darker. Just, we suspend our disbelief. It's dark up there all the time, no matter what time of day it is. Fine.
Right.
But I don't know how far down that road they could have gone before you're just like, well, wait a minute. They're not in the mine. You know, they're in the house during the day, and there is at least a window somewhere.
Right.
So it's a little tough to square.
It is, well, and when you said they're not in the mine, I thought, well, why not? Why isn't he like lowering food down into a mine shaft, say, or like a well or something where they could maybe? But I think the movie is so invested in this idea of the teacher and the student bonding over having had bad home lives that the monster does have to be in the house.
Yeah, the monster has to be in the house. And if Lucas was feeding his father and brother through a mine shaft, that's him keeping them at home is him trying to keep the family together.
Right. Yeah. No, I recanted that idea almost the instant I had it for thinking along those same lines.
There is also a flashback, which maybe not necessary, but it does kind of elucidate exactly what the process was of how this came to be. We see that Dad and Aiden came home, and Dad shuts himself in this room at first. He's like, go away, I'm sick. And then he like frantically installs the locks on the outside of the door himself.
Yeah.
And gives his son's instructions. Lock this behind me. Don't come in. Don't let me out. No matter what I say, no matter what I do, don't open this door. And then we also see a snippet just after that. Dad, Aiden is sick. And Dad just sort of like roughly hauls Aiden in after him.
Uh-huh.
And then Lucas is alone. And I think that all, obviously, like we've said, that has to happen in the house.
Right. I rather like Jesse Plemons. He's grown on me over the years. He hasn't been around for all that long.
Mm-hmm.
He's growing in stature now. I think he's becoming like a character actor leading man, and I thought those were extinct. You know? So he's kind of keeping the dream alive. He's in the new Martin Scorsese movie, Killers of the Flower Moon. Is that what it's called?
The mid-aughts were that brief shining era where Paul Giamatti was leading movies.
Right. Yeah, basically after the death of Philip Seymour Hoffman, it was like, all right,
fuck,
we're done for. Every time I look at Jesse Plemons, I think of that Patton Oswalt bit about, is it Brian Dennehy?
Yeah. Character actors, who gives a fuck if we're fat?
Which is about him and Brian Dennehy gorging themselves at some buffet, some Hollywood event, where all of the skinny celebrities are not touching the tuna pate or whatever. They do, I think, commendable job of keeping the Native American mysticism to a minimum. You know, it's not like Graham Greene sniffs the air and like deduces it's Wendigo season.
Yeah.
You know, the word Wendigo is only uttered after they've found the dad's burst open skin chrysalis. You know, like it's relatively indisputable at that point. They found human teeth marks on more than one corpse. There's lip service to the idea that like, oh, that's just mumbo jumbo, but it's not. The movie doesn't harp on about it. And Graham Greene doesn't turn into some kind of raving like Dr. Loomis character. He's very matter of fact and kind of unassuming about what Wendigos are and how they work. It's like he's telling them how to differentiate between two different kinds of snakes, which have the same coloration, but only one of them is poisonous. You know, it's like he's giving them wilderness advice.
Yeah.
Or like, these are which mushrooms are safe to eat.
Exactly. I said while we were driving back from the movie theater that I could have used more Graham Greene in
Certainly.
This movie. And I hold to that, and I think it's because his role and his performance is exactly like you say. It's not, I don't want to oversell this hypothetical misstep, but I guess it's not exploitative, you know, culturally exploitative. It's just like you say, he knows what he's talking about and they don't.
Right. Well, and when I used the word mysticism earlier, I didn't mean that any, I'm with you. I want more Graham Greene. In fact, I think the movie probably would have benefited. You know, I lean left, and I think that representation matters, but it's not the hill that I choose to die on where movies are concerned 100% of the time. However, I think this is one case where I think the movie probably would have benefited from more indigenous characters and perhaps even being set in or around a reservation. Because I think that, you know, Scott Cooper obviously likes depicting, not maybe likes is the wrong word, he's made a career out of depicting Rust Belt blight. And
yeah,
as bad as this town has it, the nearest reservation probably has it even worse.
Yeah.
So I feel like his instincts ought to, if you're gonna pursue that, I don't want to call it an aesthetic, if you're gonna pursue that milieu to its nth degree, I feel like it probably has to take you there eventually. And this would have been the story to do it because it pertains with Native American folklore. But also, I think that the Jesse Plemons character, this in over his head rookie sheriff, him trying to manage unrest on a reservation would have been really interesting. I don't necessarily expect this movie to be Blood Quantum, you know, just because it's about Wendigos. And I don't expect 99 out of 100 movies to be like fucking Do the Right Thing or whatever. But I think that there could have been a good deal of tension there and socio-political import to do with, again, this sheriff who's in over his head trying to quell the fears of people belonging to a culture that he doesn't understand or appear to have much respect for. You know, maybe when he takes the sheriff job, he doesn't even realize that the reservation is his jurisdiction. And so he's kind of begrudgingly sniffing around, trying to attribute these bodies to train accidents or wild animal attacks. And, you know, his sister can still be the protagonist. I don't know. There's enough downtime in this movie that I think you could have brought in the stuff I'm describing on a subplot level without it hijacking the movie or bloating it, and it would have been a welcome addition, I think. When I brought up the word mysticism earlier, it was just to say I'm glad that it's not depicted as some like Colors of the Wind thing where it's
sure,
like being psychically intuited. You know, it's just folk wisdom and common knowledge in Graham Greene's life and his background. And I think if we'd had more people in his circle, not to say that he has to live on a reservation, but maybe he has connections, family, whatever, I think that one or more Native American characters talking to one another could have given this movie just, you know, could have taken it to the next level, potentially, just in fleshing out the overused word lore, or in making the Wendigo more of a credible presence and more of a menace, because you've got Graham Greene talking about it is very good by itself, but if you have two characters who both believe in the Wendigo talking about the Wendigo, something about the power of their shared belief, I think, could have just kicked things up a notch, if that makes sense. I mean, it just automatically makes the monster more intimidating in my mind.
Yeah, and you do have a shared belief in a sense when Carrie Russell is, as I put it, picking up what he's putting
right,
down.
Right, but she doesn't do anything more than sit there and nod appreciatively.
Yeah, she doesn't have the knowledge. She just has an agreement.
Uh-huh.
Rather than a, oh yeah, right, that fucking thing, Jesus.
Right.
That sort of reaction.
This is not a horror movie. I guess it's a thriller, but more of a character study. I only thought of it as a consequence of what I was talking about before with my wish that the teacher's damage had been held in reserve until later in the movie and not deployed via slightly trashy child sexual abuse flashbacks. I think that there's a movie, I'm pretty sure it's Netflix original, or I saw it on Netflix anyway, called The Kindergarten Teacher with Maggie Gyllenhaal.
I don't think it's a Netflix original, but fair enough. Proceed.
It's about a teacher who takes a concerted, kind of unhealthy interest in one of her charges, who's young, you know, elementary school age, who she believes to be
presumably
some kind of,
in kindergarten.
Yeah, well, oh, yeah. Fucking. Whereupon antlers spring out of my face because.
Better find me a flare.
Yeah, right. I'm not human. Yeah, no, obviously he's a kindergarten kid. He's a gifted writer, or she
decides he is.
Decides that he is, not totally arbitrarily. And she starts to sort of inveigle herself into his life in increasingly inappropriate ways, and eventually more or less abducts him because she decides that his parents and peers can't appreciate his genius the way she can. And it's not like a fatal attraction thing where she's just like a harpy or like a mad woman. You know, she's relatively sympathetic, at least initially, and you know, throughout. Anyway, the movie never comes out and says she's like this because of this. It never pins her weirdness on something that happened to her in her formative years and doesn't attempt to connect any dots like that I can remember. It's just sort of a teacher-student relationship that escalates slowly and inexorably. And when I was watching the ice cream shop scene in this movie, I was sort of starting to tune out the dialogue, you know, the ice cream is my favorite vegetable and all that, and think like, boy, I wish this was weirder. You know, I wish this was a little more mysterious. I wish that I didn't know what was happening in either of their heads, because, well, it's just unusual to see a teacher and a young elementary or middle school age student interact like that in public. It's so easy to trip people's stranger danger alarms,
yeah.
You know, it's kind of fraught in that way. And I wish the movie had leaned into that more. And I feel like if the stuff to do with Julia's father hadn't been so cut and dry, there would have been nuance there and you wouldn't have known quite what you were dealing with. And the kindergarten teacher is a good example of how to do basically that same story. You know, teacher takes an unusual interest in a student. The kindergarten teacher kind of demonstrates how to do that without resorting to pat psychosexual explanations for all of the weird behavior. And it's not a horror movie. I don't even know necessarily that I like the kindergarten teacher more than Antlers. I just like that aspect of it more than the
corresponding.
Yeah, more than its analog.
Antlers.
Yeah, in Antlers, correct. Shame, the Michael Fassbender movie just occurred. That's another example of a movie where the whole time I was waiting for it to be revealed that, is it Carey Mulligan?
Yeah.
I kept waiting the whole movie for it to be revealed that he and Carey Mulligan had like an incestuous upbringing or that they'd been molested or something. And it just never, nothing like that ever comes to light. You're just kind of left with these two deviant characters and their damage is a little bit unknowable And I think that's a even less relevant example than the kindergarten teacher. But that's the kind of thing that I typically respond to.
Yeah. So my recommendation is going to be a movie from 2017 called It Comes at Night. It's a movie that, honestly, I ended up liking a little less than I hoped seeing the trailers for it. Because it's a movie with a very tense trailer. I would recommend checking out the trailer for It Comes at Night and just enjoying that. And then if you intend to watch the movie,
know that you're being lied to.
Know that you're being a little bit lied to. Because there's less of that. But the reason I recommend It Comes at Night following on the heels of watching Antlers is because they both have a very similar tone and aesthetic, particularly the night scenes.
Yeah.
During the day, there's some divergence between the two, although they both have a lot of forest going on. But when both movies are at night, the lighting and the color palette are in many ways like mirror images of one another. They're virtually identical. And there is a lot of tension in the best parts of both of those movies at night. And yeah, I enjoyed It Comes at Night. Again, not as much as I'd hoped it would because the trailer lied a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But it's still a good movie. It's still worth watching. The director has made two other movies that I like to varying degrees. He directed Krisha from 2015, I think, which I like pretty well. And then I really liked Waves,
mm-hmm.
which was his last film. So, yeah, check out It Comes at Night. And then, hell, if you like that, check out his entire filmography, which amounts to, so far, three features.
Yeah, Krisha is occasionally held up as a horror movie just because it's so anxiety-provoking.
It is, but it's not
no.
a horror movie.
No, it's I wouldn't
we,
I wouldn't
we watched
so.
It, and we know firsthand together that uh-huh. it is not a horror movie. Anyway, I guess that closes the book on Antlers. So, until next time, I'm Jim Smith.
I'm Matt Gerandese, or am I?
Perhaps you're the Wendigo.
Uh-huh.
We're the Shock Doctors. And we will see you next time. As always, we have some acknowledgments. Our music was composed by Will Connor. Audio for the bumpers was taken from Antlers Final Trailer HD Searchlight Pictures, uploaded by Searchlight Pictures. All rights reserved. Our next episode will be up on Sunday, November 14th, and we will be discussing Edgar Wright's homage to Giallo and swinging 60s London, Last Night in Soho. See you then.